This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hello.
And with Kara Warner.
Hello.
We have a lot to talk about. To the point that last week I said we would get into talking about spring TV. We will eventually, but I just don't think we've got the time for it. Please enjoy your TV shows. Speculate on what will have Emmy buzz. We'll get there eventually, I promise. But it's award season. Of course, we've got too much to talk about. The BAFTA Awards happened this past weekend. None of us were there. Our international tickets got lost in the mail, apparently. But we watched them. We want to talk about the winners and then look ahead to the SAG Awards, which are this coming weekend and may or may not mirror the winners at BAFTA. We watched all of the shorts again. We're going to talk about the short films, one of my favorite things that we do all year. But before we get into that award season stuff, or I guess looking ahead to next year's award season, because Richard, you've been back to Arrakis. You've seen Dune 2. Yeah. And the buzz on this is really good. The social reactions have been up. By the time you hear this, Richard's review will be live. And it sounds like even for the people who weren't as sold the first time around, it really delivers.
I was one of those people. I was an early, not a Dune hater by any means, but a Dune sort of meh-er.
Was the headline on your review, Dune Gets Lost in Space? Am I remembering that? Okay, yeah. Woo, I'm not sure that was very popular.
No, and I realized I'd used that headline for a different space review movie review like a couple years prior. Whoops, sorry guys. Yeah, no, I mean, I think obviously it's Denis Villeneuve and he makes beautiful, eye-popping films that have, you know, incredible soundscapes and, you know, and that was all there in abundance in the first movie. But because it was bifurcated, you know, it was part one, which was not really advertised before people started seeing it. I was like, felt a little bit like unsatisfied by the movie. I thought it was a lot of style and no substance. This second part, though, really gets into the meat of the story that was set up by the first film. And while the surprise of the visuals and the landscapes and all that has worn off a little bit, I was really much more engaged in the narrative and figuring out why each character is sort of like positioned the way they are and what all this prophecy is and all that. There's still stuff that I was confused by. I have not read the books. I apologize. But all told, I found that it was like, you know, it feels long, but in a good way. It feels like a really big epic, like reading a satisfying novel. And for that, I appreciated it. It does maybe set up for future Dune films that I believe Villeneuve has said he could make eventually, but he wants a break. But it also stands alone as like a conclusion to this two-part series.
That's interesting because I feel like I'd heard that it was kind of an unexpected cliffhanger, much like the first one was. But it seems like this one's a little bit more settled.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cliffhanger in that it says like these characters, their story continues. But if you were just, you know, interested in this particular dynastic power struggle between House Atreides and House Harkonnen and, you know, the Spice and the Fremen and all that, that it's not fully resolved. But like there is a kind of conclusion of the chapter, at least. And I felt satisfied by that. Maybe other people won't.
Does the addition of Zendaya properly, or Austin Butler, or Florence Pugh, or any of the new people, does any of those performances feel like it's what's really elevating it this time?
Yeah, I mean, Florence Pugh doesn't have as much to do as I'd hoped. She does narrate some things, so you hear her voice more than you see her, maybe. And, you know, Zendaya, like, kind of just shows up at the very end of the first film. I mean, she's in some sort of, like, dream sequences, but, like, this she's really, like, present for, and she gets to do action stuff, and I think she really, like, holds her own against, like, the huge scope of this film. I mean, she's not a stranger to it. She's been in Spider-Man movies and stuff, but no, she's really good. For me, the one that I kind of rolled my eyes at when I saw the trailer and some of the first looks was Austin Butler, yet again, doing some sort of, like, crazy transformation in a different voice. But I think he's really excellent in the movie. He plays.
That's so exciting.
Yeah. Like, it's a really good. I mean, I haven't seen The Bike Riders, but, like, this is, for me, his kind of follow up to Elvis. Well, I guess you could count Masters of the Air, whatever. So he's done some stuff, but, like, a big transformative movie role. It really works. He's doing the most eerily spot on Stellan Skarsgård impression because he plays his nephew. And it's like, I guess that Austin Butler doesn't really have his own voice anymore. He just now
does not
imitate other people, which is fine. He's really good at it. So I thought he was a really, like, compelling villain who, you know, look, I'm only human. Even with, you know, the pale white makeup and, you know, all that stuff, he still looks really good.
He's great in The Bike Riders, too. It's a very different kind of thing for him because it's not what you're talking about. He has to do very little, and he exudes this kind of unbelievable movie stardom in that movie in a way that made me feel like, yes, he will be around for a while.
Yeah, he has it. And it's interesting to have him paired in this movie with these two other young stars, Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya, who are, like, also being looked at as the great movie stars among the great movie star hopes of a new generation. Right. And I think they all do a really good job in this movie. I wonder about its awards chances. I mean, again, like I said, like, the sort of shock, the surprise of what Villeneuve had crafted, it has passed because we've already seen the first film, and this is more just like a chunky, like, almost action war movie, where the other one was much more about establishing place and mood and all that stuff. So I wonder,
dreams and costumes.
Yeah. I mean, look, all of that stuff is in abundance in this film, but I just wonder if the Academy will be as, like, enraptured by it the second time around.
I was thinking about what would have happened if they did release it, you know, as planned in October, because Warner Brothers already had a lot on their plate with Barbie and then Color Purple and Wonka, neither of which went very far with the Academy, but they certainly got campaigns, especially the Color Purple. So it could have been a lot. So maybe the extra runway will help it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Do you want to talk about Kraft Oscars for next year? How confident are you feeling?
I mean, look, you know, sound, cinematography, costuming.
Richard. No. That's all Madam Web. You need to.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I mean, I think that we talked about you, or you guys talked. I loved the episode about the best casting Oscar, but you didn't talk about the best worm category that they added. And I really feel like
it's true.
That Dune could be a strong contender there. We don't know, you know, what, Blitz, the Saoirse Ronan movie, if there are any worms in that. You know, I don't know. But
best creature category. I'm here for it.
You know, we're trying to find a branch governor, and they're stuck in the sand. It's just a bit hard.
It's like Rick Baker and two other people, like, doing best creature.
I mean, the MTV Movie Awards is going to have a best popcorn bucket award this year, and I think it's a runaway for Dune.
Oh, God, that's right. I forgot about that. You do see a lot more of the sandworms in this one. So if people thought that they were shortchanged on that in the first film, don't worry.
I mean, they were pretty thrilling the first time around, so that's very promising.
Yep, you get a Mad Max Fury Road-esque sandstorm. I mean, you know, he really, like, if possible, because the first movie is pretty big, Villeneuve really turns up the volume on this one.
God, you mentioning Mad Max just made me realize that, you know, I was thinking about, like, Warner Brothers and coming into next year's Oscars with, like, a big effects contender. You know, they have Barbie this year, the big blockbuster, but they got Furiosa like 2 months later. You know, I think it might not be fair to Furiosa to be like, yeah, we'll have the same Oscar trajectory as Mad Max, because that was so unlikely. But that will be a very interesting process for them if both of them really pan out.
And the scuttlebutt is that because it's a George Miller film and it's coming out at the right time, that Furiosa will likely premiere at Cannes. But we'll see.
That feels very plausible to me.
I can't wait for that.
It's exciting to have like early March movies to talk about. You know, I think there's been stuff out there, but for us who've seen, you know, the Oscar contenders months and months and months ago, it kind of feels like the calendar at long last is turning over again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that Dune, you know, feels big enough as like a real proper kickoff to the next season of movies, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The early spring blockbuster method that, you know, Fast and Furious was like the one for such a long time. I wonder if maybe we'll go somewhere more interesting now.
And 300.
It's been a rough January, February, too. So,
yeah. Yeah. My Madam Web screening on Friday. There were other people there, which shocked me, but not the hottest ticket in town.
Someone at a party this week, past weekend, like asked me, like, you know, what's good at what should I see? And I was like,
have you seen Perfect Days?
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, I was like, Mads Mikkelsen's, you know, period piece film.
Let's get back in business out there, guys.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/littlegoldmen today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp. HELP.com/littlegoldmen.
David, you were on BAFTA duty to some extent for us this weekend. They were happening live in the UK. They're not as easy to watch live in the US for various reasons. Maybe someday we can fix that. But you were keeping an eye on it and wrote about it for us on Sunday, where Oppenheimer won a bunch of stuff, which you could have written hours before the show. I think we all knew that would happen. But there are some interesting stories coming out of it all the same, kind of beyond that, which I was really intrigued by. What caught your attention the most from these BAFTA winners?
The most surprising win was American Fiction for Best Adapted Screenplay, yeah. Which I had already considered a pretty strong contender for the equivalent Oscar. But in that category, you had movies like The Zone of Interest, Poor Things, Oppenheimer, all of which won multiple other BAFTAs, and All of Us Strangers. All four of those movies made the BAFTA long list for Best Film. American Fiction, this was its only nomination with BAFTA. It was not long listed for Best Film, even, and it, for reasons we talked about last week, the BAFTAs can be a bit tough on a certain kind of American film.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite notable that it beat all those movies out, which the group ostensibly liked more, because much like the Oscars, you have the branches voting for the nominees and the whole membership voting for the winners, which is why they can be a useful barometer. And this clearly rose to the top of that pack.
Do you think that there was something like what we've been talking about with Barbie, where the lack of nominations kind of created a wave toward giving it something? Does that work at the BAFTAs?
I don't think so. I mean, it's certainly possible. The movie came out very recently in the UK. I would imagine because it's an American indie with a largely black cast, it was maybe a bit more difficult just for some of that membership to seek it out. And clearly they finally did, and they liked the movie a lot. As we've talked about, it has a really canny ability to play to a wide range of audiences, that people who the joke is on can feel in on the joke, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that helped it a lot, just the fact that it was finally seen more widely there, because I suspect that was a big part of the problem. But yeah, coming off of that, I feel like it's a very strong contender to win that Oscar now. The only difference in the chemistry of that race is that Barbie competed as an original screenplay with the BAFTAs, as the campaign so wished. The Academy forced it into adapted, and as we've talked about, it has some momentum there as well.
Not to derail talking about BAFTAs, because I do want to talk about other winners, but that adapted screenplay thought is fascinating to me, David, because I think it might not have been you, it might have been someone else who saw American Fiction win and was like, okay, there we go, that's the Oscars. But I feel like the Barbie factor is so huge at the Oscars, and American Fiction is now certainly stronger, but I'm not sure it changes my conviction that this is where Barbie is going to run away with it.
Yeah, I remain pretty skeptical about Barbie for the Oscars. I think the fact that it didn't win any BAFTAs, again, the BAFTAs do not correspond with the Oscars. They have their own tastes, but they do signal momentum. And that's been the one thing we've really been tracking for Barbie, is how much momentum has this movie gained off of the, I'm not going to call them snubs, but the Oscar omissions. And it lost production design and costume to Poor Things at the BAFTAs. It also lost with art director. So it's in a tough spot, I think, to win anything other than song right now. And I haven't quite seen evidence that it is surging in a way where it would beat American Fiction in a race where it's such a clear writerly movie. It's clearly being embraced. And, you know, that win to me reminded me of Coda winning adapted screenplay a few years ago at BAFTAs. It wasn't even nominated for Best Picture there, but it was kind of the first time that someone other than its actors had been recognized. And it was like, oh, something's happening here. And of course, it went on to win PGA and then the Oscar. I'm not saying American Fiction's winning Best Picture, but it did remind me of a similar sort of something is happening here.
Yeah. And like, you know, you could look to America Ferrera getting that somewhat surprise Oscar nomination and be like, okay, so it has more support than we thought. But then Margot Robbie didn't get in at the Oscars. And I just feel like with Barbie, there might be a sort of fomenting sentiment that, like, hasn't that movie gotten enough? Everyone who made it got so rich. Like, it's been talked about for, you know, 8 months or however long it's, you know, like longer than that, you know, from trailers on, it's been in the cultural consciousness for like a year plus. Whereas American Fiction is a movie that Academy voters or maybe even BAFTA voters like felt like that they were kind of either discovering something or bringing it to a larger audience by giving it a big award. And it sort of, you know, clarifies these voting bodies' mission to sort of highlight film. You know, Barbie doesn't need any more highlighting, you know, might be the thought. So I don't know. I kind of feel like there's some of that psychology in play where the Academy clearly likes American Fiction and will want to give it something. And Barbie, they might feel, has gotten a lot already.
Right. Although I just feel like the sentiment for Greta and Noah is still pretty strong. Yeah, maybe.
Yes.
That's what I keep thinking is like who, when the voters are, you know, making their selections, like how do you decide between Cord Jefferson and Greta and Noah?
Well, Greta Gerwig doesn't have an Oscar, which I think is like not, you know, she's barely 40. Like, it's not a crazy thing. But I do think, like, given her track record that she has had with her first three movies, like, it does kind of start to feel a little crazy. Like, she didn't win for the screenplay for Lady Bird, which I think was very much an American Fiction kind of thing. Like, fresh new voice, made their first film. We're so excited. Like, but it was the same year as Get Out, and Jordan Peele took that spot. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's the Academy has been rude to her exactly. But I think she's overdue in a way where Cord Jefferson is like, again, the fresh and new, exciting person who we can assume might be back. But again, sorry, I keep contradicting myself.
That's a good
point.
Fresh
and new, exciting voice wins the screenplay Oscar a lot. That is a familiar pattern here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's moving. That race has definitely taken a new shape. And Barbie just adds some complexity to it because it hasn't been competing and adapted anywhere else. So that's kind of an unknown factor.
I don't know who I would predict to win at this point. If you're participating in our Oscar pool, which, by the way, we're still adding people, so keep an eye on your inbox, and you've already made your ballot choices, I envy you, because I don't know where I want to go on this one.
It's way too early to be making those choices, folks. You know.
I mean, you know what? Maybe it's not. Maybe, because usually, you know, we talk ourselves in circles around the shorts and think we know what we're doing and get them all wrong. So go with your gut. Do whatever works for you.
If... if I could say one thing maybe more broadly about American Fiction winning and the overall shape of the BAFTAs, one thing I noticed is it's almost too strong of a year for any challenger to emerge to Oppenheimer, because every movie that you might think is going to take that spot as like the runner-up that's surging, they all get a little something. Anatomy of a Fall wins original screenplay. The Holdovers wins an acting award, also wins casting. There's a lot of support for that movie. Poor Things wins a lot, but it misses also in some categories. It feels like there's a lot of affection for a lot of movies, and then you have this juggernaut that probably because of that can't really be taken out.
Yeah, they're too busy fighting for second place, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Or do so many people think it's going to win anyway that they vote differently?
But for too many movies.
Right, right.
Yeah. There's no coda to Power of the Dog, right? Like, it's so spread around.
Spotlight to Revenant, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And Oppenheimer is stronger than, I would say, all of those movies from the recent examples of, like, the big movie. You know, I think I meant to say this last week, but didn't. But, like, if it was Maestro, if Maestro was in the top position that Oppenheimer was, if Oppenheimer didn't exist, I think it'd be a really different scenario. Well, to talk about Oppenheimer, David, it did win, let's see, picture, director, actor, score,
cinematography, editing.
Cinematography, yes. It kind of
supporting
split the
actor.
Crafts. Supporting actor, yes, indeed. It had, like, the exact night that we would have expected it to. So I guess not a huge surprise, but does the strength of it at BAFTA just double, triple cement what's going to happen at the Oscars?
Yep. I think that's all there is to say on that one.
Yeah.
I mean, Cillian Murphy winning at BAFTA over Paul Giamatti was not a surprise, right?
Right.
Right.
But I don't know that that necessarily says that Giamatti... I don't know. I feel like that split feels likely to me. You know, the Giamatti ends up winning the Oscar and Murphy takes the BAFTA. But, you know, because those categories don't always line up. I mean, we can talk about Best Actress at some point. But like they are predictive in some ways, but also not predictive in others. So at least I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth.
No, I mean, they can get everything. They can pick everything differently or they can pick everything the same. They've done both.
Yeah.
Last year, they had completely different choices from the Oscars above the line, and meaning every single category. And then I think it was the Nomadland year, which was only a few years before that, everything above the line was the same. So it can veer one way or the other, but there's a way to look at it where you can maybe identify, okay, they don't like this movie as much as the Oscars do, Everything Everywhere All at Once, for instance, or this is a place where Cillian Murphy will... even the score with Paul Giamatti, that might not necessarily translate to the Oscars. I do think that race is very close, though.
Yeah, and we'll talk about SAG in a little bit and how that might potentially swing that pendulum once more. We talked last week about the supporting categories, about how Robert Downey Jr. or Davine Joy Randolph could lose at BAFTA and yet still be locked for the Oscars. And now they're double, triple cemented for the Oscars, which is not a huge surprise. But, you know, good for them for just... getting up on that stage over and over again and making it all sound fresh every time.
I know that something like this has happened before, but it's somewhat rare for someone like that Davine Joy Randolph has won like almost every precursor, right?
It's pretty remarkable. Like, I mean, I want to say that Octavia Spencer had a similar run for The Help.
Yeah.
But even then, there was some cloudiness there with Jessica Chastain winning a lot of critics' prizes because she had all those movies that same year.
Right.
This has just been an unstoppable train. I mean, she does not lose anywhere, and she will not lose anywhere. I will put that on the record. It's pretty incredible. And I saw her in a room. I had moderated a Q&A with them, and she's unbelievable. She's unbelievable. So that's a small reason why. But she really is just an unbelievable presence on the trail as well.
Her speeches have been really good, you know.
Yep.
And I think Downey Jr.'s speeches have been good as well, you know, which counts
very Brad Pitt-esque.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Which is a good tone for an older, sort of more like Hollywood commercial actor to take at these things, humbled, but also like, yeah, like it's time, you know, like a kind of a really smart mix of that. Whereas Davine has been like, yes, I'm newer to the scene, but like, you know, I'm very poised and like, I belong here, you know, like I think she's been really good about that, a similar mix of humility and also like kind of confidence in a way.
I'm going to be honest, watching that little YouTube clip of her crying, calling out Paul Giamatti was crying, got me crying a little bit. I was like, this is really lovely.
Yeah.
Is this what Laura Dern did for Marriage Story? I'm trying, because I feel like supporting actress does this sometimes. Like, you just have an actress who everyone has been fond of from something or another for a long time. Like, sometimes they're more veterans, like Laura Dern or Allison Janney, or like Lupita Nyong'o was a newcomer but just kind of ran away with it. I feel like they're, like, these sweeps can happen in this category more than most, and I don't totally know why.
Lupita Nyong'o lost both BAFTA and the Globe to Jennifer Lawrence for American Hustle. I will remind you.
See, this is why we need you here, to fact check me in real time.
That was a weird dual race that probably shouldn't have been as competitive as it was, but it went right in the end.
What was Anne Hathaway's track?
Oh, that was quite, quite a steamroll, yeah, for Les Mis.
There's a movie called American Hustle. What?
You know, Richard got four acting nominations.
I love that movie.
They did, in fact, get over on all those guys.
They did. I think to Richard's point, it's somewhat different when it is an actress like Devine J. Randolph who's never even been in the race before.
Yeah.
Like Laura Dern or Anne Hathaway had been nominated before. And those were a little bit clear cut where people, you know, in pre-screenings at festivals saw that movie and was like, okay, their time is here and they will win. In both of those actresses' cases, it was very much like the one scene rule too. But this is like, it's nice to see. It's nice to see an actress who's been really great for a number of years in this industry get to be in the kind of movie that would allow for this kind of campaign and run and see the industry just completely embrace it. I think it's very deserved, and I do not think she will be stopped.
We were talking about the Oppenheimer Kraft wins and how Poor Things basically took the other half of the pie there. The Poor Things has a ton of nominations. It is in kind of a tight race for basically all of them. We've talked about Emma Stone a lot. We can talk about her BAFTA win if we want to. It does make me wonder if it is stronger against Barbie in a lot of those craft categories like makeup and hair and costume and production design than it's giving it credit for. Or is this just a Euro on Euro bias and Barbie will win out in America?
So Barbie also lost the Guild for Production Design Art Direction here in the U.S. to Poor Things. There is a part of me that still thinks that Barbie will be really strong there. I think that there's been a really good campaign for that part of the movie. It's such an obvious strength of the movie. The design is incredible. Yeah. So I honestly hope that Barbie can pull it out there. It feels like the place that it can win outside of song at this point. But yeah, I think your point about Poor Things is really interesting, Katie, because to my eye, it could win like five Oscars and it could win zero. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, makeup and hair, I think, is very close with Maestro. Maestro beat it out at the Guild Awards for makeup and hair over the weekend. Actress is competitive, which we'll talk more about. And then, yeah, you have these craft categories where it's kind of running up against Barbie. And I'm not really sure who will win.
I just wonder with the production design, when I saw both Barbie and Poor Things, those were the two top of mind that I was like, oh, these two will be competing for production design. I just wonder if there is a little bit of snobbery at play, right? With comparing the two, despite the brilliance of both.
The inevitable dynamic in a lot of these below the line races is they can lean period, they can lead costume drama, and obviously Poor Things is the furthest thing from your typical period drama. But I think that that is where that kind of snobbery or just that kind of preference comes into play. Barbie is a more, I think, exciting winner in those kinds of races for the Academy and a little bit different for them. But it is a little bit more of a leap than what they usually do.
Yeah.
I think that I have fact-checked this correctly, is that the record for the most Oscar nominations without a single win is jointly held by The Turning Point and also Steven Spielberg's Color Purple with 11, which is how many nominations Poor Things has. So if it wins nothing, it will tie the all-time record, which would be such a strange outcome for such a popular movie. But that's how it works, right? You can be super popular and win nothing, and that's how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, we're going to talk about the SAG Awards, which are happening this weekend, where many of these same actors are nominated. I think we can kind of safely earmark Robert Downey Jr. and Devine J. Randolph's speeches once again. But Richard, you were talking earlier about Paul Giamatti and Cillian Murphy. Who do you think has the edge at SAG between the two of them?
I would say Giamatti, maybe.
Me too.
Yeah, just because it's the transition from, you know, the BAFTA voters to the SAG voters.
Yeah, I think there's a different kind of sentimentality, if you want to call it that, for Paul Giamatti in the SAG voting pool. Whereas Cillian Murphy, a great actor, you know, who has done a lot of good work in his native Ireland, in the UK, in America, too, you know. But I just feel like the slight edge might go to Giamatti just because he has worked with a lot of American actors who are the people voting mostly on the SAGs across television and film.
Yeah, I agree with Richard. I expect Paul Giamatti to win on Saturday. He has won, I'm counting, 4 SAG Awards.
Wow.
He won Best Supporting Actor for Cinderella Man at the SAG Awards.
I mean, that was his long overdue makeup nomination for Sideways.
Yes, it was.
SAG probably nominated him for Sideways, so they got it right.
They did. He also won for Too Big to Fail in the TV movie category. Oh, I don't think he even got won an Emmy for that. So they wow. like him. Yeah. I think it's the Jessica Chastain rule a little bit, where this is an actor who's worked with everybody, who is beloved in the community, and who is getting a showcase part. Chastain even won for George and Tammy with SAG and didn't win anywhere else. And I think Giamatti may be a similar kind of figure with this group. It just feels like the place he would win. I don't know. Even if he doesn't win the Oscar, I think that this is where, you know, he will get a moment and we will be talking about this race until Oscar night.
Yeah, I think the goodwill factor is huge in the sense that he's worked mm-hmm. with so many major actors in a supporting role and as part of ensembles that I think people are really excited to celebrate him.
The actress question, it feels very open to me. I know I keep saying that. I mean, Emma Stone is the front runner at this point. I think it's quite difficult to call Lily Gladstone a front runner, just given that she hasn't been nominated by BAFTA. And she didn't win the Critics' Choice Award either, which is a big consensus vote. Yeah. So this is kind of her last stand, I would argue. It feels like the Academy did not nominate Killers of the Flower Moon in a few key places, like Best Actor or Screenplay, that it's not so hot on it that it would overperform there. That said, I think she could win here. She has an obviously great narrative. The campaign is... kept her front of mind, but Emma Stone is not lost anywhere yet. So maybe this is a little bit simpler than we're making it out to be.
And I think that when we think of somebody winning 2 Oscars in relatively quick succession, it feels kind of insane, but it's not that rare.
It happens.
Yeah. I mean, like Mahershala Ali and Christoph Waltz both did it in supporting actor really fast, which was kind of like strange when it was happening and even stranger in retrospect because they won the first one for like a really great standout role that no one had any problems with. And the second time you're like, wait, really? Again? We're just going to do this? But like Frances McDormand wins 2 Best Actress Oscars, her 2nd and 3rd really close together for performances that were just really undeniable, which is in many ways what Emma Stone's in Poor Things is.
Yeah, I think it's, and I mean, to her credit, it is a matter of like, is this undeniable? Like, mm-hmm. this is, there's a ton of love for her and just respect for the performance. And that can be enough.
How old she is compared to when Jodie Foster won her.
I was
2nd.
Thinking about that because Jodie also won 2 pretty close together.
She's really close together. And she was, let's see, she was about 30 when Silence of the Lambs came out. So, she might have been, Jodie Foster might have been younger when she pulled this off. But yeah, it feels like Emma Stone's very young to be a 2-time Oscar winner, but that's how the Best Actress category works sometimes also. It's a, you know, star at the kind of the peak of her powers. So for SAG, we're going to be watching those races. Does anyone have a firm prediction for the ensemble category? I think we've talked a lot about how that one can really go its own way. And The Color Purple is still sitting right there, which we've been talking about a few times. But or does it really just come down to Barbie and Oppenheimer?
Oh, man. I mean, I love a surprise, but again, I think there could be, you know, for SAG, even though it's actor's body, we could say there's a little more superficiality with actors. Hey, maybe. I would love them to give it to Barbie, but I bet it goes to Oppenheimer.
What if American Fiction stays on the Coda path?
I mean,
hey, I'm fine with that.
That
too.
Would really, then you would have 2 weeks of everyone being like, American Fiction is going to win Best Picture in a total surprise. And like, it wouldn't be wrong, right? Like, it could be, it's a totally reasonable speculation.
We still weren't saying that when Coda did both the BAFTA screenplay and SAG Ensemble. It was starting to be talked about. I feel like in this case, it would be even harder to jump to that conclusion, even with that backup. But I don't know. It is one of the movies that you hear the most about, just, you mm-hmm. know, going from Academy room to Academy room. There's a wind in its back. I don't know how far that goes. Probably not far enough. Again, the unique factor in this race is Oppenheimer is just huger than most frontrunners at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that just is typically in this season been too much for anyone to overtake.
And with a bigger cast, I don't know, just like sheer size of the cast helps them at all. But it's got what, like 85 speaking parts or something like that. It's a it rides strong.
Punish them for not including Alden Ehrenreich or David Krumholtz in the nomination.
Yeah, we've worked hard to move past that. We're trying to hide our resentment there.
It's not as bad as Killers, so
no,
that's true.
I hope they get to go anyway. I'll put my chips down on a Barbie win. I feel like it's an incredibly worthy ensemble. It's a wide voting body. Everyone has seen the movie. SAG isn't as snobby as the Oscars can be. They gave it to Hairspray. Why not?
Oh,
I'm gonna say for sure.
Yeah, if they give it to Hairspray, that would be, I mean, listen, I'm gonna hope for that too.
I'm just hoping for, in general, for some sort of like big SAG surprise. You know,
yes.
Like Emily Blunt winning supporting actress for A Quiet Place, or I don't know. I was looking at the I was trying to figure out if there's like a Chastain situation that could happen with, like, you know, maybe Annette Bening wins a SAG.
Ooh,
because like
that is the situation.
Jessica Chastain wasn't nominated at BAFTAs that year because it was that strange year where, like, I think a very small committee of people did the whole nominations, and so it was
It was just none of them made it. It was complete. There was none of the Oscar nominees were BAFTA nominees.
Right. So I don't know. Sorry, I was kind of gaming that out. I know we're not talking about Best Actress anymore, but
we're always talking about Best Actress.
No, we haven't.
I'm just trying to control myself. Yeah, I'm just trying to control myself and not bring her up every week. But it is back of mind.
Wait, no, David, do you want to throw out your Tony Shalhoub theory? Speaking of SAG surprises,
you know what? I would love to. those listening may not know that the hottest ticket in town is a Tony Shalhoub SAG Q&A. It's unreal. A lot of people who want to see him at events, I moderated one, get turned away. This is for Monk's Last Case, a Monk movie, which is the sequel film that aired on Peacock to the series Monk, for which Tony Shalhoub won many Emmys and SAG awards. And I think he could beat Steven Yeun for a limited actor. He's nominated. Sam Elliott won last year, 2 years ago, for 1893. As a fan of that series, and he was not even nominated for the Emmy. So these can go, and Jessica Chastain has mentioned one for George and Tammy. Those can go in their own way. So that's my wild card prediction. I think he will win for that.
Our younger listeners probably don't remember that in the, what was it, early 2000s or something, there was just years where, like, Tony Shalhoub was just, like, picking up every award possible for Monk for year after year. And
it was like Bryan Cranston Breaking Bad level. It was just every award.
Like, could
Tony
not
Shalhoub
stop winning.
Won 2 SAG awards for Monk and then 4 for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Oh, wait, no, sorry. Some of them are ensemble. Never mind. But he did win twice on his own for Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
And I think he won 3 Emmys individually for Monk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People just really like voting Shalhoub, you know? So
it's a fun one to say. Why not?
Yeah.
Know that fizzy feeling you get when you read something really good, watch the movie everyone's been talking about, or catch the show the internet can't get over? At the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we chase that feeling 5 times a week. We talk about the buzziest movies, TV, music, books, and more. From lowbrow to highbrow to in between, catch the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
So we're going to close out the show by discussing, as promised, all of the Oscar-nominated shorts. They're probably playing in a theater near you. There's a lot. They're being programmed all over the place. They're making, money. For not a ton of money, but it's always nice to see that people are going to see these in the theaters. And a lot of them are available online. We'll kind of try to flag the ones that we're talking about where you can find them easily. The animated ones, for some reason, are the harder ones to find. But I wanted to start with the live action shorts category, which I think can be one of the most fascinating to discuss for reasons good and bad. It has a little bit of a reputation, I guess, maybe among us or maybe other people, where there can be a lot of winners that are about something really, really heavy and terrible and in a format that is pretty blatant I think because of the nature of the, you know, the short running time. And this year carries on that tradition and then also goes in all kinds of directions. To start with the positive, though, I had one of these that I just loved and I thought was really terrific. And I'm wondering if you guys agree with me. Knight of Fortune made me so happy.
Yeah,
I loved
totally.
This movie.
Beautiful.
It felt like it should be a short, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't feel like it was just a sizzle reel for a bigger movie, which some of these often do. And I appreciated that. It went in little surprising directions and all that. Yeah, and I think it was just fun seeing something that, unlike some of the other nominees in this category, I would say a solid three of them, wasn't like, yeah, like you said, kind of like almost bordering on PSA.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Which is a strong tradition in this category. You might remember that Riz Ahmed won for a film kind of about like immigration and racism in 2020. There was another one about like police brutality. And I think the closest one this year would be Red, White, and Blue, which is about restrictive abortion bans, basically. In for me, very well-meaning, but kind of not well executed, which is often what happens in this category. And again, you don't want to like beat up on small films that not a lot of people get to see. But that one felt like very much in the tradition of the category, which makes me think it might win, but not as successful as some of the other ones.
Well, also, it was like a surprise. Oh, that's what this is about?
Yeah.
That happens in a few of these. So.
Yeah. A twist. I mean, I liked Brittany Snow in Red, White, and Blue. I was on the jury at South By last year, and we gave her her directorial debut in a movie called Parachute an award. So it's interesting seeing Brittany Snow kind of reach for new things in her career. And I thought she was good in the movie, but I thought the twist as it was presented was a little cheap, maybe. And I understand why they did it, because it should be shocking and horrible. I think it must be loosely inspired by a story from Ohio, but
yes.
I don't know. It felt a little bit, I struggle to, I hate using this word because the whole point is to manipulate, but it felt a little manipulative, I guess.
Yeah. Because I think what you learn in watching these shorts sometimes is the really successful ones say a lot without saying anything out loud. Like, you can really use symbolism and glances and quick stuff because you only have people for such a short period of time. And some of these that are really trying to get a message across kind of lean much more on didacticism, but get rewarded for it. I still don't know what to make of The After, which is one of two of these shorts that are available on Netflix, the other one being Wes Anderson, which we can talk about in a minute, because The After has all of the trappings of one of these like big topic movies. But it's just basically like David Oyelowo as a grieving dad, like, and not because he's not grieving because of like some larger social issue. It's just like something horrible happens and then he is sad about it. I was
really horrible
with the music, like kind of pummeling you towards.
And they show the bad thing. In a way that I was like, whoa.
So you know? Upsetting.
Yeah.
To devote a significant portion of your short movie to the bad thing and not the... I don't know. It just felt a little bit like... Yeah. And I think there is sort of a social thing, you know, about like knife attacks in London and all that. But that to me very much felt like a sizzle reel for a bigger movie.
Yeah. But the bigger movie is about like overcoming grief by driving a car for straight, like I'm not even sure where it wants us to land at the end of it.
Right.
Well, I think it's suggesting an arc that would be fleshed out in a longer film, but
sure.
Right, maybe finding, yeah, that was the first one I watched and I just thought, oh, are all of these going to be this devastating?
That is a tradition of the shorts, as you're in a bad mood for many of them. Where'd you guys land on Invincible, which is available on Vimeo, as I try to shout out where you can actually watch them? And I believe based very closely on a true story that happened to the director.
That one also had a twist because I thought I was watching a French movie, but it's a Canadian movie.
Mm-hmm. I figured it out and I don't remember how. I think like someone, I was like, that person doesn't look French. They're in North America. And I was very proud of myself.
Yeah, it felt a little distant to me. I don't know. Maybe that's the word. I thought that the acting was really strong, but there was something about it that I just struggled to connect to, which is another tradition with some of these live action shorts, is they, because of the limits of the time frame, if you don't use that, the medium appropriately, I think it just can feel a little bit unsatisfying. And this was one where I liked a lot of the elements. I liked the way it was shot.
Yeah.
But it just felt sort of straightforward in a way where it was hard for me to get on its level.
I can't remember. Did Were we told about the kind of true story at the end or the beginning? I felt like it was at the end.
At the end, right? I think.
Yeah, because I think not that we need any more direction, but I might have been more invested if I had known that from the jump. Because it's...
That's a good point.
It is, you know, that's a dark one too. Beautifully shot. I agree with... And I think, David, your word is really, really appropriate, distant, because... Yeah, maybe if we had had the little based on a true event or dedicated to, I definitely think that would have helped me be a little bit more invested.
It's worth flagging too that in a few of these we're being vague because they are sort of dependent on reveals,
sure.
Which also can be tougher to pull off in, you know, 15 minutes more or less.
Yeah. I guess all this leads to the question of the last short. Is Wes Anderson going to finally win an Oscar for The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, which is the last nominee in this category?
I don't know. I think he's pushing with the whimsy. I love Wes Anderson aesthetic. I do. I think it's fun that you can kind of escape into that world. But I think he's pushing it with this one because, you know, not knowing anything about it going in, just that, you know, I was sitting down for a Wes Anderson story. And then, of course, the based on a Roald Dahl short story, I believe. I definitely was like, well, what is the point?
Yeah.
Even though there's an incredible moment, it's not, I don't think it's a spoiler. My favorite moment is there's Benedict Cumberbatch in drag for a hot second. Mm-hmm. That was my favorite little
Many
little
different costumes
vignette.
In a very short yeah. period of time.
It's like a pop-up book.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think whether or not Henry Sugar wins, it might reveal something interesting about the Academy's psychology.
Yes.
Because like they've been weird about Wes Anderson for years.
Yeah.
You know, like not nominating Gene Hackman for
Tenenbaums.
Oh, Tenenbaums. That's still upsetting.
Stuff like that. So if Henry Sugar wins, my question would be, did you just see a famous person's name who's been nominated for Oscars before and vote that and say, I don't have to watch the other four?
That's a really good point, especially you all probably know this category a lot better than I do, but I could see that happening.
It's a new kind of dynamic. Like, you guys have been doing this longer than I have, but in the years I've done this with you, we've never had to kind of weigh this type of entry that had this full rollout from a studio, premiered at Venice, to competing against a bunch of movies that virtually nobody has seen outside of the Academy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if it doesn't win, then I'm like, did they just really hate him? You know? Like,
yeah.
I mean, it could be for other reasons. Like, if maybe Night of Fortune wins because it is the most complete, I think, short film in the bunch.
Yeah.
But I don't know. The Wes Anderson thing really does complicate it. You're right, David.
I feel like this is not the movie that wins this category, typically.
Right.
It's just not.
Yeah.
They like... I mean, we usually get it wrong because it's usually a movie we don't like as much. For starters, this is a full vision. I mean, that cannot be denied, even though I do agree with Kara. So is it going to be a more straightforward, issue-driven movie? Like, I think Red, White, and Blue felt like a winner that was also unsatisfying to me, which I'm trying to do better at judging these days. But yeah, there's a huge complicating factor in the fact this has a full campaign. It was very well received. It really was out of Venice. And it's widely seen. The way that the shorts voting works is it's an opt-in kind of thing. So who knows what the makeup of the voting body for these awards is and how much they like this movie and how much they like the other movies, because you do get a high concentration, at least, of people more earnestly judging the films against one another.
You know what this makes me think of, and it's not quite a one-to-one comparison, but Les Pupilles was a kind of our runaway favorite of a live-action short last year, and it was on Disney Plus, and it has Alfonso Cuarón and Lice Vorvacher, who's a major director, and I think we all thought it would win, and it lost to a very nice movie about two Irish brothers. Big year for Ireland last year. I know we talked about that.
Yeah.
And so emotion.
Nice.
Is it nice? Am I forgetting the plot of this movie?
Well, I think you're being kind, but I'll stop.
Honestly, I'm trying to like remember the basics of it. But I think emotion and sentiment, and it doesn't even have to be like about a big topic, and it can be like more delicate than not. But Les Pupilles and Henry Sugar, I think, have in common that they're like really beautifully made. But literally, thinking of Les Pupilles, they're like, there's no moral to the story. That's kind of how Henry Sugar works too.
Right.
And I don't know that wins you over in the end here.
Yeah, unless people love, I mean, I do like all of the famous actors that like to go play with Wes Anderson, right? Like, that is fun. So maybe, are they, you know, whoever votes, are they going to be excited to see all the All the people who agreed to do a short.
I mean, it's you got to watch it. If you haven't seen Henry Sugar yet, just fire it up. It's a good 40 minutes to spend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on to the documentary category. Speaking of emotion, often this is where you really get your heart ripped out. I remember very vividly the year there was one about like children in an orphanage who'd been affected by Agent Orange and just feeling like such deep despair while watching the short. And this year, they're not. They're about major topics in a lot of cases, like, you know, economic inequality and, you know, public schools and book banning. But none of them really go for the like, here is this devastating story that will tear you up. And some of them, or at least one of them, like Nai Nai and Waipo, are delightful in every possible way. It's a really fun set. I think it was my favorite group of any of the shorts that we watched. But I feel pretty sure that I know the winner. I think it's going to be The Last Repair Shop.
Yep.
Okay, good.
Yep.
Okay. That is my favorite one. That's my favorite one.
Wait,
glad to hear
are you
that.
Guys disagreeing?
No.
I was feeling confident about that.
I would have said Nai Nai and Waipo.
Same, Richard.
Well, he just had a big movie at Sundance, and like his name is kind of in the industry. Sean Wang did. It's sentimental. It feels distinct, you know, and unique, whereas Last Repair Shop feels a bit packaged to me. But maybe the Academy doesn't care about that.
I just think, the Nai Nai and Waipo, the campaign is really fun and strong. Like, they're doing a really great job with, I think the last thing I saw was him showing or having having Nai Nai and Waipo like read the reactions to their short, which is very charming. That they're just doing their own thing, living together, and oh hi, people watched us, people like us, which is very cute. And I haven't seen really the campaigns for any of the others.
I think with the doc shorts, they tend to like a fuller package narrative, feeling like they've come away learning something, which is not. I actually really love Nai Nai and Waipo, and I think that the challenge for that movie as a contender is it's this really whimsically constructed slice of life for these two women, and the way that they just get up in the morning and particularly interact with their grandson when he comes to film them. It's really a sweet and warm movie. But Last Repair Shop and a few of these others, I think, have, you know, the backing of premise, of subject, of this is a thing that is happening and we are bringing you into this world. And in Last Repair Shop, you meet these really heroic figures as part of an institution here in LA who provide free instrument, like turnips or repairs for students in the district. And you learn a lot. These are the sort of last ones, as it says in the title. And it has this nice contrast of meeting these people with hearing the students' stories, the kids' stories about its impact. I found it really moving, but I also found it the kind of movie, the kind of story that could very easily be embraced as important by a group of voters.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, too, because I did not Google the history of the category because I figured someone here would tell me more about it. But you bring
you
up
didn't
a great,
follow the shorts religiously, Karen.
I really haven't. But I think that's a great point in that Nai Nai Waipo definitely is not like the others. And I hearing a little buzz about it beforehand, when I watched it, I thought, oh, that's it, in the sense of it's a beautiful little slice of life instead of a full package, as you did really well described, David. But Last Repair Shop, I also is my favorite, my personal favorite, but I loved how they kind of told the story differently than I expected. I thought it might just focus only on the kids, but I loved that you get to meet these very different and differently motivated people who do the repairs.
Well, and speaking of the history of the category, it's directed by Ben Proudfoot and Chris Bowers, who were nominated together in 2020 for a film that didn't win. But Ben Proudfoot won on his own for Queen of Basketball. So they're kind of heavyweights in the documentary short category. And I also think there's a tendency for LA movies to do really well here.
Oh.
There's this really odd winner a while ago, Heaven is a Traffic Jam on the 405, about an artist in LA. There was one a few years before that was like kind of funded as a part of a project from an LA private school. And so, you know, Chris Bowers and Ben Proudfoot know a lot of people. And then I'm watching it. And I kind of was like, all right, like the emotions, like everyone has their heartrending story. And then, man, they put together that orchestra at the end and they have all these graduates of the LA school system yes. identifying by their class year. And this like this beautiful music that Chris Bowers composed. And it got me. So it's really kind of like weapons grade emotional impact yeah. for anybody, which is why I think it will win.
I think Barbara of Little Rock, too, is my second. That was my second favorite, I think.
It's, that's a really good one.
Some of those documentary subjects always make me feel especially lazy about what I'm doing with my free time and my, you know, efforts to try and shape the world in better ways. So that one, I think, is beautifully done and could motivate other people to kind of adopt what this wonderful man is doing, trying to help, you know, people get a leg up.
I was just going to say that, you know, the LA-ness of it all, the insider-ness of it all, means that we should probably bring up ABC's of Book Banning because yes. it is mm-hmm. co-directed by Sheila Nevins, who is the longtime right. head of HBO Documentaries, a huge player in the world of documentaries, mm-hmm. Very known in the industry. The movie is, I thought, kind of cloying, but, you know, about a worthy subject about Florida yes. book bans and schools, but like, I don't know. I just feel like, again, depending on the psychology of voters, like, oh, Sheila's nominated. I'll vote for her, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm surprised it got in. It's so straightforward in a way that I feel like they usually try to avoid. So that may be telling. I don't know.
Those kids are really fun, though. I loved all those interviews yeah. with these sassy kids.
Yeah, the kids are great.
Yeah, as in the last Repair Shop shoe, too. I love the kids in that one.
But I thought The Last Repair Shop also looked great. You know, it was yes. really nicely filmed. And this one, it was fun.
Yeah. Island in Between is the last one we haven't talked about. It's a little bit odd movie. It's very personal. It's kind of quiet. It's yeah. taking a lens on Taiwan and China and the relationship between the two of them. It's produced by the New York Times, which has a kind of strong history in this category. But I wouldn't imagine it too much of a threat for a win for all the reasons I just said.
Yeah, I agree with you. I definitely learned, right? I did not know some of the nuance there, but I also kind of was left a little question mark, like, oh, what is it really about?
Yeah.
I want to see that full documentary.
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah. You know,
that would actually be really interesting.
Last Repair yeah. Shop is complete in it, mm-hmm. it as its own entity. So
Nine Nine and Waipo are going to have a 10-part series on Bravo. So
oh, thank
there's
God.
More to come for that.
It's interesting. I think it was other than Nine Nine Waipo, was the shortest one, The Island in Between. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it probably could have stood to be a little bit longer because there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. yeah. And Nine Nine Waipo, is that Disney Plus? Is
yes,
that
the one yeah. I was just okay, going to say, and Hulu. All of yeah. these are streamable. That's Nine Nine Waipo is on Disney Plus and Hulu. Barbara of Little Rock is on The New Yorker, so I guess you have to get past the New Yorker paywall, but it's there. Island in Between is New York Times, same deal. Last Repair Shop is on Disney Plus and Hulu also. It's a Searchlight production, and ABC's Book Banning is on Paramount Plus. So go nice. Put those streaming services to work. All right, let's end by talking about the animated shorts, none of which are Pixar or Disney or... easy to watch really at all, as far as I can tell. So hopefully you go catch it in your local theater. Not quite as grim as some of these lineups have been before. Like there's a couple years where you watch the animated shorts. You're like, oh, you couldn't show any of these to a child. Good solid number of those this year.
Yep.
I think the simplest one is my favorite, which is Our Uniform, which is this yeah. fascinating animation, stop motion thing about uniforms that girls wear in Iran. And it's very short. It's about 8 minutes long. But I wonder if anyone else had a personal favorite.
My personal favorite is, I think, the weirdest one. And it's not even, it's one of the commended ones. The Wild Summon, which is like, I watched it twice. I'm like fascinated by this film and I have a lot of questions for the filmmakers.
Which movie?
While it was one of the commended ones.
Yeah, they put two in the program that are commended.
Yeah, yeah. I did see that.
Kara, I commend you for watching the commended ones.
I was just kind of stopped like in my watching, kind of like, what is the movie? It's like a little sci-fi, a little fantasy with a pretend nature doc happening. Anyway, but back to the ones that actually are in competition. I think I agree with what you said, Katie, in Our Uniform, because it's beautifully done. Animation is unique, I think. And it's really informative without being super depressing. You know, I think mm-hmm. it does a great job of shining a light on a different part of life, a different slice of life in a beautiful way.
I feel like it's going to be Letter to a Pig. Mm-hmm. I liked it a lot.
It's weirder than I thought it would be, and reveals itself in interesting and I found surprising ways. It will, I think, be confusing to some people.
It was very actually. Confusing to me. I honestly still don't know what it's about. So maybe we'll offline. Yeah.
But I think in the same way, though, that like, look, for some reason, if your film, your contender, has the Holocaust as a central component, the Academy is more likely to embrace it.
It is still somehow true, even, you know, however many years later.
We have
later.
The Zone of Interest. As I have said many times on this podcast, it is amazing that that movie is nominated as much as it is. And I think it's because of the subject. And this is another movie that is far artier than I think what they typically go for. But it has that immediate, you have that immediate sense of importance and gravity because of what it's about. It's really beautifully made. The sound design is really interesting. So I think it will win. And maybe that's slightly cynical, but I also would say it was probably my favorite, or at least the most, I thought, most ambitious.
I think I'm even more cynical than you. I mean, are we forgetting last year that The Boy, The Mole, The Fox, and The Horse won this category?
Was that the order? I don't remember the order at all.
I'm looking at the Wikipedia. So to my mind, then, how does War Is Over, inspired by the music of John and Yoko, not win?
Yes. And they've been all over, too. They've been all over.
It also won the Annie over the weekend.
Oh, see? I didn't realize
that's
that.
The one thing. It happened the one time I opened up Twitter.
That the Annies movie, were in there. It's like it's too soon after All Quiet on the Western Front for that movie. I think I was not prepared to go back into trench warfare. But it has big feelings to it more than any of the other ones, which, Richard, you might have a point there.
And John Lennon and Yoko Ono are credited in it as inspiring it. And
it's the first title that you see.
Yeah, it's produced by one of their kids. And I feel like that one is just going to kind of check a lot of boxes. But if they go the more arty route, Letter to a Pig, 95 Senses from the makers of Napoleon Dynamite, Oscar nominees now. Mm-hmm. That was an interesting, quirky one, but I think it's maybe a little too odd to catch the attention of the voters.
I did like it. Tim Blake Nelson's voice performance is really terrific.
I liked it too.
Yes, me too.
We didn't talk about Pachyderm, which is kind of like dreamy and beautiful and then very disturbing when you kind of realize what the story is about. Again, a common theme in short films. It's like, I mean, all of these, I say this every year, like the different styles of animation and learning what you can do kind of all over again with this medium is constantly fascinating. So seeing them, all five of these, so close together is fantastic.
That was what I loved about Our Uniform, too, was the way that it really used the form to kind of enhance the story it was telling. I thought it was really effective.
Yeah,
it's nice. They all do seem very different in their animation, I think, which is nice.
Yeah.
You know, for people that are not as familiar with the category or the art form, to just get a slice. People that are only going to see Disney and Pixar movies, right? It's nice to see.
Yeah. Well, it's why every year, like, I just really encourage people to seek all of these out. Like, you know, they're in theaters, are not all so long this year. Like, I think you could really knock them out in a pretty solid afternoon at your local theater. The animated shorts, like I said, like, most of them I don't think are available online. So you really do have to go out to the theater. So as we were just saying, there's not really anything else good in theaters. So go see the shorts. You'll be glad that you did.
So David and Katie, you're saying Letter to a Pig, and Richard, I think you have a strong case for War Is Over.
I think I'm siding with Richard, honestly, on War Is Over.
It's the one that looks most like a Pixar movie, except there's like blood and guns and stuff. But like, but the people look like Pixar people.
They do. You're right.
Thomas Newman composed the score. He's in many Pixar movies.
But does that make it too much of a ringer, like Henry Sugar? You know, like maybe people are going to want to try to find the artier thing and then Letter to a Pig, which has like really, you know, pertinent subject matter, whatever. Like, I don't know.
I think this is maybe me giving away my opinion of War Is Over, but I am choosing to pick the movie that I think deserves it.
Okay.
It's okay to give away your opinions on the shorts. For people who watch all the shorts with us, that's what they earn. So
true.
I know, but it really didn't get us very far with Boy, Fox, Mole.
No.
Boy, Mole, Fox, Horse.
I still remember the derision in Richard's voice last year when he quoted it. And it's like, what do you want to be when you grow up? To be kind.
Oh, God. Just the worst Oscar win of last year.
Yeah. That was a beloved moment. So again, I'm going to warn everyone, we usually get these wrong, and I'm not sure that's going to change this year.
Time well spent.
We'll do our predictions later on. Yeah.
Before we sum it up, David, because again, I am very not well versed in how the machinations of the category. You said it's an opt-in. What does that mean to the layperson?
It's actually more opt-out, because Academy members can basically say that they haven't watched the movies and therefore not vote for them, which some of them don't. And so you get a panel-like system of people who are more, I don't want to say rigorously, but more, you know, they will have watched them closer to voting most likely and will be more considered in the way that they vote for them. And so a little bit more personality comes out of those picks, but also sometimes not the best choices.
But is there anything stopping anyone from, like, voting and not having watched them but voting for Wes Anderson anyway because they want Wes Anderson to win an Oscar?
No, and that is one of the unique things about this year, right?
Yeah.
We don't really know how that will change things, so that may very well happen.
Yeah. Well, we'll have our formal predictions for this and all the other categories in a few weeks, but hopefully everybody goes and watches these in the meantime and then tell us how wrong we're going to get our predictions. This is the tradition. That does it for this week's show. We will be back next week. We're going to do our annual Oscars flashback, talking about the 2004 Oscars, the Return of the King Oscars, for those of you who remember back that far. So prepare, watch your clips, get your New Zealand accents ready. It's going to be a really fun time. Find us in the meantime at Vanity Fair, on social media at VF Awards Insider. I'm also out there at Katie Rich, and Richard.
At Boy Mole Fox Horse.
And David.
At War is Over.
And Kara.
I don't have anything cute or clever, but I appreciate you all. Kara J. Warner.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for what we hope to hear from the Academy when they announce next year's Oscar host goes to Kara Warner.
Benedict Cumberbatch in drag.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.